Okay. Good morning. So my name is Ben Katz. We're going to be doing a text-based session this morning about modern academic Bible study and modern orthodoxy, if you will, I never know what to title these things, but for lack of a better title, that's what I decided to give it. So I wrote this book called A Journey Through Torah, and one of the things I try to do in this book is to show that that a lot of what passes, I think, for modern academic study of the Bible is not quite as scientific as some of its proponents make it out to be. On the other hand, there's really a lot that we have to learn, I think, from modern archaeology and modern, you know, philology and ancient Near Eastern languages. And what I thought I would do in the session this morning is give you some examples of each. And I'll pass out a handout in a minute. So just to get started, one of the things that a lot of modern academics have a problem with when they look at the Chumash is that there seem to be a lot of stories that are told more than once. They call them duplicates. So, for example, the most, and many of these are in Sefer Bereishit, in the book of Genesis. So the first, one that comes to mind very easily is that, Be'er Sheva, the famous city in the Negev, is named twice, once by Avraham, once by Yitzchak. There seem to be two creation stories. You read the first chapter of Bereishit, and it seems to be, you know, God is creating the whole universe, and man and woman are created kind of like at the end. And then you read the second chapter, and you kind of get the sense that man and woman are kind of like more like the center of creation. So there are different kind, and a lot of these stories not only are duplicated, but they seem to have different styles to them and whatever. Another example, like Hagar is thrown out of Abraham's house twice, once before Yishmael, once when she's pregnant with Yishmael, and once after Yishmael is already born. So there's a lot of these kinds of kinds of stories. Again, mainly in Sefer Bereishit. Probably the most famous example, and this is the worst example probably that you can probably find, is there's one story that appears three times, a triplicate, the so-called wife sister stories. So there's three of these stories in Sefer Bereishit. One of them deals with Avraham and Pharaoh, Paro. One of them deals with Avraham and Avimelech, the king of the Philistines, and one of them deals with Yitzchak and the king of the Philistines. And the first text-based thing I want to do this morning, is I want to look at two of these stories. And again, we have everything here in Hebrew and in English, so you can read whatever is more comfortable for you. I want to look at the first two of these stories and see, really, are they really just duplicates? Or are they really trying to teach us something? Or do they really both have just completely different themes? And are they trying to teach us completely different things? And that's why the Chumash includes them more than once. So I wanted to take a couple of minutes now. And, you know, for some of you, this will be, you know, very old hat. But for some of you who are not. So I just want everybody to spend a couple minutes reading, both stories on the first two pages of the handout. Again, it's in Hebrew and in modern English. And then when you're done, in a minute or two, you'll just look up, and then we'll start chatting a little bit about them. Oh, and by the way, this is going to be a little interactive. We're not just going to hear me talk the whole time. So we'll get, hopefully, some dialogue. No, please, sit anywhere. I said, just the first two stories. Don't go on to the third one yet. Something completely different. We have a fast reader here, I see. I mean, you could look at it if you want, but it'd be distracting. Yeah, it's okay. Well, you have another minute or two. Okay, are most people done? You need another minute? Okay, so let's just start simply now. And then there's no wrong answers here. So you don't have to be, no one needs to be embarrassed or ashamed or whatever. There's no wrong answer. So let's just start. What are some of the obvious similarities between the two stories? Please.
In each case, Abraham is afraid that he'll be victimized or killed in order to get his wife. And so he asks her to pose as his sister.
Good. Any other similarities that anyone can see? I mean, that's the basic core, right?
The person who takes her is horror-struck at what has happened and chides Abraham because of it.
Correct. Good. Okay. I'm sorry, Marianne.
But he gets rewarded at the end. Each time he makes off with a whole lot of loot.
Right. So each time it works out well. Let's put it that way. Okay, good. Another similarity. Yes, please. Yes, right. So there's a lot of similarity between the two stories. They have a common, you know, background, if you will, or a common, you know, whatever. So again, a lot of people look at this and say, how come this story appears two times in the Chumash? You know, is it some kind of, is one a garbled version of the other? Is somehow, was there something lost in transmission somewhere along the line? So how come these stories are both there? So now let's try to ask the opposite question. How do the stories differ? Or maybe even a better way of looking at it is, let's maybe, all right, either answer, how do they differ? Or let's maybe concentrate more on the first one. Does it remind you of anything? Right. Okay. So let's elaborate on that. So what Marianne is, and again, this isn't just, you know, me talking. A lot of, you know, people who look at the Bible in a more literary fashion, like people like Robert Alter in his wonderful book *The Art of Biblical Narrative*, talks about this, where people are very. He wants to see a certain literary theme. So we'll expand about it. So Marianne, so tell me what you mean. So how is the first story from Bereishis 12 foreshadowing the Exodus from the end of Book of Bereishis and Book of Shemot? How does it happen?
And it's Pharaoh.
And why do they? And why?
There's a famine in the land.
Right. Yaakov and his children eventually migrate down to Egypt because there's a big famine in Canaan. Here, there's a famine in the land, and Avram goes down to Egypt. Right. So the beginning starts out the same as the Exodus story, right? Huh?
Hashem doesn't tell Avram to go down to Egypt, or he will.
No,
Hashem tells Yaakov to go
Well, kind of. You're right. I'm not saying it's exactly... Right. No one is saying it's exactly the same, sir. But again, a lot of the themes are similar, right? There's a famine. Avram goes down, just like there's a famine later on, and Yaakov and his children go down, right? They go down to Egypt, and then Pharaoh gets stricken with plagues. And here in this story, it's not exactly the same word, but here he gets Makot, here he gets Negaim, right? What else?
Well, the first story, Avram tells Sarah in advance what he's going to say, what he's going to do. The second, he doesn't bother anymore.
Right. So there's a lot of ways. So there's a lot of things that are interesting here. You know, at the time of Genesis 12, you don't know that Sarah is really his half-sister at the beginning of the story. By the time you get to Genesis 20, you already know that. In other words, it's interesting. When you look at the genealogy, when Sarah's genealogy, or when she's first introduced in the Chumash, I think a chapter before in 11, at the end of 11, they don't tell you. It just says his wife, Sarai. Doesn't say that she's his half-sister. Later on, as part of the explanation, you get that I wasn't really lying, she really is my half-sister. But again, by the time you get to 20, you know this already. But here, at the beginning of the narrative, you don't know that. Good. Anything else about this story?
So why doesn't Avram tell Pharaoh that she's of his sister, like he said to Avimelech?
Well, he doesn't actually say it. He doesn't actually say it to Avimelech. So the way the story... So you're asking a different question, which is really not what I was going to talk about today, which is also a good question, which is, what was the whole logic behind this strategy to begin with, right? So there's a lot of answers to that. The traditional way of reading the story is that, presumably, if I'm married to this beautiful woman and the king wants her, the king is not going to take a married woman. So he's just killing is not as big a problem as taking a married woman, apparently, in the ancient Near East, right?
He's telling afterwards to Avimelech, look, she's really off my sister.
Right.
But when he gets thrown away by Pharaoh...
Yeah, he doesn't say it there. Maybe they want to save some of the surprise for later on. It's a good question, really, because with Yitzchak and Rivka, she's not a half-sister. She's his cousin, right? So there, this excuse doesn't work. He really is lying, if you will, right? But here, Avram is at least telling a half-truth, or at least a partial truth. No, it's not. It's supposed to be his half-sister, I think, is what the text seems to be saying. Not a niece, I don't think. Yeah, I'm sorry. One, then two.
Also, from the language in the Hebrew between the two stories, it's clear that Pharaoh's intent was, I don't say malice, but it was. I mean, he wanted to take Sarah immediately and have her away, whereas you see with Avimelech,
okay, that's great. You know what? Hold that thought, because that's what I want to get to when we talk about the second story. Because the second story, as where I'm leading with this, has a completely different theme, and it's supposed to completely teach you, I think, something else. But that's one of the important differences between two stories that you picked up on. Very good. Is that what you were going to say also?
The first story is very short.
Yeah, the first story is shorter.
The second is
more... Right, it's more expensive. Exactly right, too. Yeah, it is. And we're going to get to that one more second, too. Yeah,
Tamar. We don't find it so bizarre to think that Avraham might be killed because of his wife when we know that later David does get a husband killed in order to take her.
Oh, that's good. I didn't think of that. Yeah, that's actually a very interesting... It's a very good point. I never thought of the two stories like that. You know, there's an enormous number of similarities between the King David stories and what happens in the Joseph part of Bereishit. The names are similar, the towns are similar, and that's, again, not what I was going to talk about today, but there aren't as many between Avraham and David, but that's a great one. I never thought of that.
But David is the one who is doing...
The killing.
Was doing the killing, but he's the one who is following the ways of Hashem.
Except I don't think he's following the ways of Hashem when he has Uriah Hachiti killed.
That's a further question.
Avimelech accepts the rebuke of Hashem in the same way that David did from that time.
The accepting the rebuke is also, just hold that, because we're not quite there yet. Yeah, Marianne.
It's also like because you have Moshe is there, and he's, you know, just finds out later, but he's there as Prince of Egypt, and you have Sarah who's there, and we don't really know what her status is, and they're both given a certain degree of power while they're there.
Sarah becomes like a queen almost. Oh, that's also kind of cute. Oh, it's interesting. I didn't think of that. That's also good. That's also good. Yeah, but she's presumably going to become some kind of either the consort to the queen, to the king, or something. You got to have some kind of power. Oh, those are all, okay, great. This is terrific. So, Bikol Tamidai Hiskalte, I learned a couple of things here this morning, too. So that's good. So let's recap now. So the first story is a foreshadowing of the Exodus. That's part of the purpose of what this story is doing here at the beginning of Sefer Bereishit. And again, the more you study Chumash, the more you study Nach, you see how self-referential the whole book or sets of books are. Doesn't mean that they always have the same ideology necessarily. You know, it's not so clear to me that, let's say, that the author of, you know, Shir HaShirim is agreeing with the author of Daniel necessarily. But the fact is that there's clearly a foreshadowing here. And that's part of the purpose of the first story. When you look at the second story, I want to start getting back to, Batyu, somebody said your name was? Okay, sorry. So the comments that Baji was making about the second story. So the second story, you said two things. The first one was what already? I forgot.
The first one was about the intent.
Ah, right. So the intent doesn't seem to be quite as bad, right? Perhaps. And what else? And the accepting the rebuke. Okay, so here's, and this question's a little harder, because what story is right before this story in the Chumash? Am I to remember? If not, I'll tell you. It's a little bit unfair question. Stom and Amora. Okay, now, when you just finish reading Stom and Amora, and then you come to this story, what is this story highlighting? Now, I think it makes your points even stronger. So, what do you think this story is now highlighting?
The realization that immorality, that there are consequences to immorality.
And that some cities are moral cities, and some cities are immoral cities. Stom and Amora are completely immoral cities. Avram can't even find 10 righteous people, right? What does he say at the end of this story? He says, I didn't know. What does he say? I didn't know that there was God in this place, right? What was his word? Rak ein, I thought, ki amarti, I thought, rak ein yirat Elohim b'makom azev haraguni al dvarshi. I thought this was an immoral place. I'm not going to say it because it should be obvious to the reader who just finished it, but not like Sodom and Gomorrah, right, where Lot and just got rescued from because the whole city, we couldn't even find 10 righteous people. This is a different kind of place. Okay, you made a mistake. You're a king. You think you can do some things, but when you realize that something is immoral, you're not going to continue. You're not going to proceed, as opposed to Sodom and Gomorrah, where the Bible tells us it was a terrible place, and the Midrash expands upon actually how terrible it was. So, instead of these two stories just being some kind of duplicate and some kind of, you know, telephone kind of, you know, misgarbled transmission, these two stories are, first of all, they're beautifully constructed, right? And they're full of literary allusions and they're full of moral lessons, right? So the first story, just think about it again, you know, the Chumash is so familiar to us, but here we are starting out, you were reading the Chumash like Lahavdil, like a novel or a book. You'd start reading chapter 12 and all of a sudden there's already a precise of the Exodus. There's already a foreshadowing of the Exodus to the carefully attuned reader. And then you get to chapter 18 and 19, and then you're reading about Sodom and Gomorrah, these terrible cities of the plain, and all of a sudden, you get to a Philistine city where, hey, the king really isn't such a bad guy. He's immoral. He'll act properly if he's told what to do. And this is especially important because the Philistines later were the terrible enemies of the Israelites, right? So you can't say, oh, that this story has some kind of, you know, agenda, because it's showing the Philistines in a good light. And again, it argues about, you know, the truth of the story, and even though these cities may have, you know, 500 years later become terrible, at this time these were fairly righteous places where a righteous man can go with his wife, and if he explains to the king what's going on, you know, nothing too bad is going to happen to him. In other words, he's allowed to marry this woman if it's his sister. He just can't marry her. Maybe it's not so nice that he took her against her will, but he's not committing any kind of terrible moral or religious, you know, act. And then he finds that he's really his wife. He says, wait a minute, I did the wrong thing. Yeah.
I was just going to say that I think just taking her against her will, to me, that's not very moral at all. I
mean, okay, but you have to remember, these were very different times. These were very different times. And I agree with you. That's why I said it the way I did. It's not... obviously it's not a particularly nice thing to do or whatever. You could argue whether it's even borders on rape or whatever, but the fact is that these were patriarchal societies where kings and men could do basically whatever they wanted, but they weren't going to violate God's law, and they weren't going to take some other man's wife if they, at least this story, he wasn't going to do it, and he wasn't going to kill Abraham, right?
Well, it's also interesting, of course, that in neither story does Sarah have any say in the matter.
Right, that's a separate issue. Right, I wasn't going to talk about that, but that's a separate issue. But again, so I think what I wanted to show you here is that these two stories are really quite different, and they're not just mindless or just careless, if you will, you know, duplications. which is what a lot of people think when they look at these stories from a purely academic perspective. I think they miss the whole literary and the whole the beauty of them in their context. Yeah.
I was wondering if there was another foreshadowing in that Abraham, by being in this alien environment, is somewhat corrupted, ready to give away his wife and ask her to act as his sister, just as Bnei Israel became somewhat corrupted when they entered Egypt.
Oh, actually, that theme would cut across both stories. In other words, whenever you leave your proper environment, you're gonna. Oh, that's very good. I like that. Another thing you taught me. Yeah, it's also very good. In other words, Jews belong in Israel, or at least in Jewish neighborhoods, right? Yeah, that's true. It's a good point. Vayera, the descent could be moral as well as physical. Good point. Yeah, so maybe he wouldn't have done this if he stayed home. He's supposed to stay home.
Well, and he just got the breed.
Yeah.
In the story before.
Right, he just got the breed. And he immediately leaves, right.
The next chapter, he leaves.
Okay, go ahead.
No, no, please.
No, we treat this as a... Go ahead, I want to
hear you. All right, I want to hear you too. Okay, so this basically, and you can do this with, again, I'm not going to spend too much time on it. For those of you who know more about this, you know, you can do this with a lot of the different things that go on in, you know, it's funny, Robert Alter, he's actually, he's some kind of a quasi-traditional Jew, and, you know, he's been accused of being like a crypto-fundamentalist by writing, I mean, it's really weird. Here's a guy, he's a respected professor of literature, he writes a book to show, it's actually a beautiful book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, it's a beautiful book. He talks about a lot of this kind of stuff in his book, and he makes fun a little bit of, like, a lot of these, you know, critics who, like, and again, critic is not a pejorative term, it's like a theater critic, right, a theater critic, a Bible critic, an opera critic, but anyway, some of these modern academics who kind of like dissect the stories and try to show that they're just duplicates of each other, whatever. So he actually makes fun of a lot of this stuff, and then people have now accused him of being a crypto fundamentalist, which he obviously isn't. But anyway, it's a very interesting approach, and I think, and this is actually oddly enough one of the things you can derive from, you know, people never read the Bible as like literature. I don't really want to say Lahav, because it really is also great literature. People never read the Bible this way till fairly recently. I mean, if you look at, like, for example, Rashi, and his comment, he's really a verse by verse or a word. He doesn't really stop at the end of a story and say, okay, what does this whole story come to teach us? The one exception that I'm aware of in traditional commentary is Ralbach, Gersonides, who in the 13th century wrote a commentary where at the end of each story he lists lessons that each story has. But that's really the exception. I mean, Ramban will have some introductions to some books and talk about themes. So he does that a little bit too. But the whole notion about like a Jacob story or the Joseph cycle, these were really modern literary terms that even the more modern Orthodox have started to use in their understanding of Chumash, and it really comes from the non-Jewish, from the secular academic world. So these are kind of interesting things, but be that as it may, there's a whole literary aspect to this as well. Yeah. They do, but it tends to be on the micro level, not on the macro level as much. See what I'm trying to say? Yeah. I'm not trying, again, there's not as much. Again, I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all, but it's really become, again, nobody ever spoke of a Joseph cycle, of a Joseph narrative in the Book of Bereshit until I think the 19th century, huh?
Thomas Mann.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. No. Well, Thomas Mann wrote 1,000 pages about it. He was so enthralled by the story. Right. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to belittle it. There's another way of looking at it. And again, I think that some of this stuff is very nice because it helps you see the Chumash, I think, in new ways. And again, it shows you that some of these things are not just, you know, random, that they're all there for a good purpose. Okay, so that was the first thing I wanted to do. I wanted to look at, depending on how much time we have, again, I know we started late, so we're going to go a few minutes later. Rabbi Brand told me that was okay. I want you to look at a completely different story now, one that I think is really almost impossible to understand without basic knowledge of ancient archaeology. So this is the tragic tale. This is on the next page of the handout. This is the tragic tale of Yiftach and his daughter. We're not going to focus so much on the details of the whole story so much as opposed to exactly what his oath was. So again, we'll spend 2 minutes, let everybody read it. It's bracketed. It's on the third page of the handout. And again, you can read it either in Hebrew or in English just to refresh your memory as to what happened there.
It doesn't seem
correct. I'm sorry, on the page before...
Yeah, from Judges 11. Yeah. Oh, I didn't bracket it? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, maybe I just put the whole thing on the page. You can just read the whole page. Sorry, I usually bracket it. And then the last page, the denouement. So if you look ahead, you'll see the answer. But just read the story first.
Is this...
This page.
You're welcome. You can call me Ben. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, of course. I'm sorry. Oh, I should have put some in the back. I apologize. Hopefully this thing is still on.
Is it still recording?
Okay. עוד רגע.
זה סיפור נורא?
כן, נורא מאוד. This is a terrible story, right?
Yes.
It's a terrible story. And I'm not going to pretend to be able to give you all the answers to the story right here, right? So what's terrible about it?
The men of it.
The oath, right. This is a terrible oath. The first thing, because I'm not going to sacrifice. Also, it brings up all these issues. He clearly didn't mean that it was going to be his daughter. He didn't mean that. So why should he have to fulfill something they didn't mean? Does he really sacrifice, or does she become an unmarried, you know, woman her whole life? There's a lot of things to talk about. But I think that one thing that I read years ago, I think it's impossible to understand this story without understanding how houses were built in the times of the judges in ancient Canaan, in ancient Israel. So if you look in the next page of the handout, I enlarge it so you can see it a little bit better, and then you can read the caption. So there's so it's interesting when you go into Israel, when you look at Israel archaeology, we know that around the time of the judges there was a lot of activity going on. You could find all of a sudden a lot of different kinds of pottery, and you have certain kinds of houses that are being built, and these houses are called four room houses. And you could see one, it's kind of an awkward old black and white drawing, but you could see kind of in the middle of the picture there, right, there's this like three-sided house. And these houses had four rooms, and this was like the standard Skokie model for ancient Canaan after the Israelite, house. You know, you have this door on the side, you have either, you know, this was the standard Canaanite, Israelite house after the conquest, in the beginning of the conquest period during the time of Judges. So you had this like this triple, again, the house that looked like this, that had four rooms in it, one room in front on each side, and the back section was split into two rooms. You see, it had four rooms, basically. But you can see that the middle, this cutout part in the middle, was kind of like a courtyard, kind of like where we would have our front lawns today. They had this courtyard, and animals used to graze there. So when you walked into your house, the first thing that greeted you was an animal, because they were out in the front yard. It would be like, I don't know, I suppose if people let their, instead of their dogs or something, roam around in the back, they used to roam around in the front yard. So he thought when he was going to, he meant the first animal that was going to come out of my house, because the first thing that always greeted him whenever he came home was an animal, because that's where they grazed, in front of the house. So obviously, what the story in Judges is, Shoftim is showing you, is that unfortunately, his daughter, they were so happy with the victory over the Ammonites that his daughter came out first with the tambourines and stuff, and he was shocked to see a human as opposed to an animal coming out of that, greeting him when he first walked into his house. Yeah.
Isn't there a basic flaw in the story? When was there any human sacrifice in Judaism. When?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, again, the background of the story is very, very troubling. And again, I don't begin to have an answer. You know, it's funny. The one example of human sacrifice that's in the whole Tanakh actually works. Well, Avram there, he tries. But there's actually a story in Kings in Melachim where the king of Moab, I think, is losing a battle. He sacrifices his son, and then he wins. That's what it says. So it's a weird story. But the fact is, you're absolutely right. It's a very hard story to understand. But again, I think it at least makes the oath a little bit more intelligible. Because if you know that the first thing that comes out of your house every day when you come home is a goat or a sheep or whatever, that's what he meant. Now again, why the words should be taken so seriously, that's not what he meant, is a completely separate issue that I don't certainly have the answer to. But I think that this really helps you understand at least the setting of the story, and it makes the story a little bit more intelligible. And you wouldn't know this without modern archaeology.
Yeah, but he says, I would say it, say whatever comes up.
Right,
he
well that's...
Have said,
he should have said something, but the assumption was, I know, you're right, and he's getting punished for that. And part of the story is he's supposed to be careful with what you say, and be careful when you make a neder. But, you know, there are all sorts of things. Like I can't make a neder against something that's against the halakha, right? Right?
There is also, I heard that it teaches us that none of them, neither the Kohen Gadol, or there was a Kohen, or neither he, the Kohen could have redeemed the oath, but he didn't go to him, and the Kohen didn't come to him.
Well, again, these are all extra textual ways of trying to get around an incredibly troubling story. And again, I'm not going to pretend to answer all the questions here, but I just want to show you at least why the oath makes a little bit sense in an archaeological context. That's all I'm trying to show you here. I'm sorry, did you have something else to say, or did anyone else?
I just said it's like a sick comedy from Shakespeare, like.
Yeah, it's almost like
someone said you know,
right.
Look at some of the Shakespeare stories, and
yeah, it's true.
The way they planned it out because they said something.
Right, or whether it's meant to be taken literally or not, these are whole separate issues. These are whole really separate issues.
The real question is, why did Hashem do that?
Right. These are very troubling stories. It's a very troubling story. But again, I just want to show you at least one little thing that maybe makes one little part of it make a little bit more sense based on archaeology. That's all I wanted to show you. Okay. It's a very troubling story. I don't have the answers. Let me just give you another couple of examples, depending on how much time we have. And these are not in the handout. I'll just say them. Moshe, right? When Moshe is named by the daughter of Pharaoh, it says, I'll call him Moshe Kimei Hamayim Mishitihu, because I drew him from the water. You know, just as an aside, you know, in the Ten Commandments, when she says that, I always think his name should be Andrew, right? I drew him from the water, his name will be Moses. I drew him from the water, his name should be Andrew, right? But it doesn't work in English, obviously. But it works in the Hebrew, Kimei Hamayim Mishitihu, right? So obviously, the daughter of Pharaoh didn't speak Hebrew. Right now, even some ancient commentators recognize this. Ibn Ezra, who is wonderful, 12th century biblical commentator, who I adore. I think he's, you know, it's just brilliant, the stuff that he says all the time. He was a little cryptic. He had an interesting life, very sad life, unfortunately. But Ibn Ezra, hi, I'm sorry. There's a handout in the back. We're kind of towards the end, unfortunately, but you're welcome to a handout. So Ibn Ezra says, you know, it's too bad I don't know Egyptian, otherwise I'd really know what Moshe's name meant. Well, now we know Egyptian. And
Is it a Semitic language?
No, it's not. So it's hieroglyphics, basically, right? So Moshe, you know, the name Ramses means born of Ra. That's what it means. Ra was the chief god of Egypt. So Ramses, there were a few kings of Egypt named Ra, which means born of Ra. Moses is the same element. It probably means born of the water. And it makes perfect sense, right? She found this little baby in a basket in the water. She picks him out and adopts him. So Moses was born of the water. That's probably what his name really means in Egyptian. And we wouldn't know that without knowledge of hieroglyphics, right? Which is kind of cool. It's a nice way to look at the Bible. So another example, Tzafnat Paneach, right? This is the name that Pharaoh gives to Joseph after he interprets his dreams. Nobody really knows what this means. So the commentators do the best they can. So Ibn Ezra again says it's too bad I don't know Egyptian, although I really know what his name was. So the traditional commentators say, well, you know, Tzafun, like in the Haggadah, Tzafun, Borech, Tzafun means hidden because the Afikoman is hidden. So Tzafnat Paneach, they want to say, well, it means the revealer of hidden things. It's not bad. It's just Hebrew. And there's no reason that Paro would know Hebrew. So Tzafnat Paneach in Egyptian probably means something like the sustainer of life. And that's a perfect name for Joseph. It's exactly what he does. He sustains all of Egypt during the 7 years of famine by the solution to the king's dreams by storing up the food, right? So Tzofnat Paneach is probably Egyptian, meaning sustainer of life, and it doesn't have to do with, you know, the reveal of... Although it's cute, it's just not correct, okay? People did the best they could, but if you don't know Egyptian, you don't know Egyptian. There's a lot of examples. Let me give you another one. This is one of my favorites. So the first line of the Ten Commandments, of the Aseret HaDvarim, is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Hasher Hotzeiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mebeit Avadim. I'm the Lord your God, King of Egypt, who took you out of Egypt, the house of slavery. Okay, so what's the purpose of that verse? Huh? Okay, good. So one question, which I'm not going to get into, is it a mitzvah or not? Which is a huge topic. Actually, you could talk an hour about this, and I have, unfortunately, in the past. I won't do it now, but let me just say quickly, if you look at the history of the interpretation of that pasuk, it's fascinating. Because till about the time of Maimonides, nobody interpreted it as a mitzvah. Nobody. So if you look, for example, at the early collections that list mitzvot, like the Azhara literature that's written for Shavuot. You know, Shavuot, of course, is the Torah, is the holiday that... from a historical perspective, you know, is the anniversary of the giving of the Ten Commandments of the Torah, right? So there were people in the early and late antiquity, early Middle Ages, who wrote very long poems trying to list all 613 mitzvot that you would say in shul on Shavuot. And these are called the Azhara literature. It's not 100% clear why it's called Azhara. The letters Azhara, if you add up to 613. Also, Azhara means warning, so maybe these are the warnings for the Jewish people. Whatever it is. If you look at this, and the Azhara literature is odd, because it includes rabbinic law, it skips some laws, it's not, and they don't all add up to 613 anyway. It's really a weird set. If you go through these poems that are hundreds and hundreds of lines, I haven't gone through all of them, but I've gone through one or two of them, they're very odd collections of laws. Be that as it may, when you get to the Maimonidean era, Maimonides, of course, is trying to establish the laws of the Torah in a philosophically sound way. You know, if he lived today, he would probably be trying to reconcile Torah and science, but in his day, he was trying to reconcile Torah with Greek philosophy. So he's the first person to say that Anochi Hashem Elokecha is a commandment. It's a commandment to understand God. And I, Maimonides, I'm going to tell you what God is about. If you believe God has a body, you are wrong, and you're not going to get a share in the world to come. That's what he says. So Maimonides tries to convince people of the correct understanding of God from a high philosophical level, and he tries to pin it to make it a mitzvah. So he pins it on the first verse of the Ten Commandments, which till his time was never interpreted as a law. But here's another way of looking at it, which I think is also kind of interesting. We've excavated, you know, there's thousands of documents from the ancient Near East. You know, there's this book by this guy called Pritchard, who just died a few years old, called The Ancient Near East Texts. It's like a phone book. There's hundreds and hundreds of these things that have been published and translated. So, it's really kind of neat. There are many treaties that exist in the ancient Near East. And there are treaties between kings and kings, and between kings and vassals. If you look at a treaty between a king and a king, it'll say, I'm the king of Moab. Now, kings in those days didn't have such huge territories. They were like you'd be the king of Skokie, right? It would be like, you'd be like the king of a city-state. So the king of one city talks to a king, and he says, look, I'm going to give you, I don't know, 500 chariots, and in return, you're going to protect me if I get attacked, right? So when a king writes a treaty with another king, it's on equal level. I do one thing for you, you do one thing for me. Kind of like a modern contract. I'm paying you $1,000, you send me 100 books. Right? Okay. There are also king-vassal treaties. So they'd be the king and they'd be the vassal. So when you look at a king-vassal treaty, the king, he's the king, right? It's good to be king. I might do one little favor for the vassal, but the vassal, because he's subservient to me, might have to do 10 favors back for me. So the king says, well, I did this wonderful thing for you. You were attacked. Therefore, you have to send me tribute and you have to send me slaves and you have to build my, you have to send me labor, whatever. So the king, the vassal might have to do 10 things. If you look at the Ten Commandments, it's written exactly like a king-vassal treaty. I took you out of Egypt. That's a big deal. But I'm God, right? I'm the king. So I only have to do one thing for you. In return, you have to do the following 10 things for me. You shall have no other God. You can't bow down to him. You have to keep the Sabbath. Honor your parents. Don't kill. Don't murder. So, and again, I'm not saying that's exactly the pshat, but the fact is, it looks just like a king-vassal treaty. And again, the Bible was given 3,300 years ago. The Chumash was given 3,300 years ago when these were common, at least among the literati. Anybody who knew how to read and write. All right, we're almost done. Thank you. Anybody who knew how to read and write understood, would have, I hate to use the word but this would have like resonated with them, right? Any scribe who's familiar with what was going on in the ancient Near East would recognize, oh, there's like a king-vassal treaty. So it's another way, I think, of looking at the first pasuk of the Ten Commandments. It's not an introduction exactly, it's what God did for us. Because God did this for us, we then have to do the rest of the commandments back for God. Yeah?
It also gives a more contemporary for that generation.
Yes.
Frame of reference.
Exactly.
Because the whole Elohim Abraham Elohim Yitzchak and Yaakov was no longer working. You know, it's like that happened
so long ago. Oh, it's an interesting way of looking at it.
So
right. It's more immediate. It's more immediate.
This is why you owe me for...
Oh, very good.
You personally owe me.
Very good.
Right.
No, it's very good. And again, framing it as a king-vassal treaty would have made it also recognizable, at least to the elite, presumably, the ones who were familiar with these kinds of treaties that were going on all around them. So it's kind of a neat way of looking at it, I think. Yeah. Look, I have no... Actually, and this is, again, just to sum up in one more minute, because Dr. Rabbi Brand gave me the five-minute warning already. You know, again, this is exactly what, in my mind, what's beautiful about modern orthodoxy, what's beautiful about this kind of approach in general. You know, it doesn't mean we accept everything from the modern world, but we take, you know, we filter out the good stuff. And there's so much to learn. You know, these guys, you know, maybe 100 years ago, there was a lot of anti-Semitism associated with modern Bible study. It's clearly not that way anymore. A lot of it is very, a lot of it is real, I hate to use the word apikorsa, but a lot of it's very untraditional thinking. But even in, but there's so much that they have to teach us. And, you know, Da'at Mikra, for example, the phenomenal Israeli Bible commentary, uses a lot of this stuff. And one of my bon mots, of course, Art Scroll, which is so anti-scholarship, they never talk about any of this kind of stuff in any of their commentaries. The Israeli commentaries do, and they're really wonderful, and there are modern Jewish commentaries that do some of this stuff as well. This is the kind of stuff that I love, and I hope I've shared a little bit of that with you this morning. If you have any other questions, I'm happy to stay, and if anyone's interested in the book, I just happen to have a few copies. You're very welcome.
Have you heard of Michael Fox?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Classes with him.
Oh, really?
Medicine.
Oh, yeah, he's terrific.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's terrific.
I'd say my first class with him.